This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You know how when you go online, ads pop up for products you've shown an interest in, or political messages that seem tailored for you appear on YouTube videos? Our guest today, Jill Lepore, has a story about a company formed at the end of the 1950s that had a plan to accumulate data about people's habits and preferences and use it to predict how they'll vote or shop. While the practice is a fact of life today, 70 years ago the idea was revolutionary and controversial. The company, called Simulmatics, a combination of the word simulation and automation, told clients it had crafted a people machine to predict human behavior. The idea attracted customers but drew condemnation from scholars and political leaders who saw it as a threat to democracy. Lepore has a new book about the company and its colorful founders, a mix of Madison Avenue admin and social scientists, and about its checkered history, assisting politicians, corporations, and the U.S. war effort in Vietnam. Jill Lepore is the David Woods Kemper 41 Professor of History at Harvard University, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and host of the podcast The Last Archive. She's written many books, including These Truths, A History of the United States. She joins me from her home in Brattleboro, Vermont, to talk about her latest book, If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Jill Lepore, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
This enterprise had a founder, a driving spirit, not exactly a technological visionary. Tell us about this guy, Ed Greenfield.
Yeah, I love Ed Greenfield. He was a Madison Avenue ad guy in the 1950s. He had a company called Ed Greenfield and Co. At a time when Madison Avenue was growing, you know, that sort of Mad Men era that we're familiar with from television, he was a bit of a small-time operator, but he was a very devoted liberal and really spent a lot of time working for liberal causes and got into political consulting, which is what a lot of advertising agencies had done, mostly for Republicans. But Greenfield wanted to bring political consulting to Democrats.
And like a lot of entrepreneurs, there was a part a bit huckster to Greenfield. I mean, he had some educational credentials that didn't exactly stand up to scrutiny, right?
Yeah. He seems to have been an incredibly loving and affable fellow in many ways. Very charming. People admired him, but they also often tended to get really frustrated with him when they got to know him a little bit better. And one of the things they got frustrated with was the bravado and the braggadocio, that a lot of what he was promoting was himself. And so there was a lot of sleight of hand. So he often introduced himself as having gone to the University of Chicago and to Yale. And I asked his surviving children about that, and they all said, don't really know that that's true. And, you know, you do what you do, you fact check. So I wrote to the registrars at all these places. And no, he had not attended those places, those schools. He didn't have degrees from them. He had, incidental affiliations with them. But, you know, he was a salesman, so he sold himself.
So Ed Greenfield came on the scene at a time when political advertising was a new thing. People just had televisions, and candidates were getting used to the idea of ad companies. And computers were new, these big hulking machines. What was the idea of this company that he put together that was so unique?
So he wanted to devise what he called sometimes a voting behavior machine, that you could take the what we know about voters, which is information gathered by pollsters, and the information that is the giant data set that is election returns, and marry that to behavioral science, and then run it all through a computer, and you could predict how people would behave mathematically.
Right. And to do this, I mean, he was a guy who was really good at developing relationships. He knew everybody. He really tapped a lot of very sophisticated social scientists of his day, didn't he?
Yeah, because he understood that there was this great new thing going on, which was simulation, computer simulation. People knew it from flight simulation. Wow, you could train pilots by having a computer simulate the experience of flight. And he knew how exciting and buzzy automation was, right? Like the way big data was buzzy, you know, a few years ago. Oh, automation, everything's being automated. So he decided to start this new company. He called it Simulmatics to kind of mash those two words together. He thought it would be like cybernetics, you know, it would be like a buzzword of the era. So in 1959, when he founded it, it seemed to him that this would be the future of American politics and also of American marketing.
This Madison Avenue ad man, Ed Greenfield, has this idea of using computers to help predict behavior. And he hooks up with a guy named Bill McPhee, who's kind of a math genius, a really interesting and colorful character. Just tell us a little bit about him and this idea that he came up with that would drive this company.
Yeah, so McPhee was at Columbia. People sometimes called him Wild Bill McPhee. He was a very erratic genius. And he worked in the field of voting behavior, trying to use what we know about election returns and public opinion polls to come up with a mathematical model that could tell you how to predict voters' behavior. And he came up with this thing for his PhD dissertation. And then Greenfield, who met everybody, he collected people, met McPhee and said, this is it. This is it. This is the thing. I've been, you know, ever since the election of 1952, I've been trying to find a way that we could use computers to influence political campaigns. And so he brought McPhee on board and he turned his, really his doctoral dissertation into a commercial product that would found a for-profit company. I think what Greenfield didn't quite get was McPhee was a little wild-eyed. I mean, during the time he was doing that research, he was manic depressive. His wife, who's home with, you know, young children, had him committed to Bellevue. Most of this work he did, a great deal of it he did while in Bellevue.
The psychiatric hospital, right?
The psychiatric hospital, yeah.
So he writes all this down on paper, and it proves to be a really powerful idea.
Yeah, and it is a really powerful idea. Like, it still is. I mean, you know, think about what political campaigns do today, right? They're collecting data about you in order to send you messages that will affect how you vote. That's now what our politics has become. I mean, especially we're stuck in our houses. That's really all that we have, right? We're not talking to people on the street or even answering the door, chatting with people about what we might do. We're bits of data being manipulated. But that idea, kookily enough, like, comes from sort of a madman in Bellevue trying to reinvent American politics.
Right. The idea was that, you know, we have this data on people and you can slice all this data up and then you can tell a candidate the impact if they decide to endorse a civil rights bill or oppose a trade agreement. You can actually try and predict, simulate what would happen. Ed Greenfield, the guy who runs the ad agency, sends this proposal because he's excited by it to a guy named Newton Minow, who happens to be a close advisor to Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic candidate for president in the 50s. He then forwards it to Arthur Schlesinger, the Harvard historian. And what's interesting is that Newton Minow has a strong reaction to this idea. What does he think of it?
Yeah, this knocked me out when I found it in the archives and Stevenson's papers at Princeton. Minow writes to Schlesinger. They've both been involved in Stevenson's campaigns, close advisors to Stevenson. This is 1959. Stevenson's thinking about running again for a third time, 1960. And Minow says to Schlesinger, like, you remember Ed Greenfield? He worked on the campaign in 56, because Greenfield had worked for the Stevenson campaign. He's got this idea, this Project Macroscope thing. Look, I think it is got to be illegal. And if it's not illegal, it's surely immoral. And I also don't think it can't work. Tell me what should we do about this? And Schlesinger writes back and says, yeah, you know, I remember Greenfield and, you know, I share all of your reservations. You know, and what Schlesinger, the great presidential historian, means by that is, like, a candidate for presidency should speak about civil rights forcefully because he or she should speak about civil rights forcefully, not because a computer says that, you know, you might win this district if you do that. Is, you know, so Schlesinger says, I worry about it, the question, implications for leadership. But I don't like to stand in the way of science, and this might work. So Schlesinger's a power guy. You know, he wants to win. He wants the Democrats to win. The Republicans have held the White House for all of the 50s.
Right. So a debate begins to emerge. I mean, does using all of these predictive tools amount to manipulating voters and manipulating an election? Or is it just good, smart politics?
Yeah. And I think, other than Minow, who has a real moral clarity around this issue, I think he correctly foresees all the problems with it. There aren't a lot of people whose questions go beyond, will it work? There's a real desperation, you know, kind of partisan desperation. There's one other guy, though, who really does oppose the project. This guy named Eugene Burdick, who was a political scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. He'd worked for Greenfield on the Stevenson campaign in 56 and had been asked to join this new endeavor, you know, would he sign on with all these elite behavioral scientists to this new project? And he said no. He foresaw the problems that it could bring, right? The way in which he says, you know, it could destroy American politics as we know.
So in 1960, John F. Kennedy is running for president against Richard Nixon. And Ed Greenfield, who started this company, Symbolmatix, convinces the Kennedy campaign to hire the company to do some research, give them some advice. They put polling data into their computers. Did they give John Kennedy any valuable advice in that election?
They did. I mean, at first they were working for the DNC before Kennedy was the nominee. And what they were trying to do was convince the DNC that the Democrats needed to take a stronger position on civil rights. Greenfield was a very, very strong advocate of civil rights, and so were all the scientists who work for what became the Symbolmatix Corporation. So they did that first bit of work, and then when Kennedy becomes the nominee, they do additional work for Kennedy. They prepare three more reports, and it turns out that in the fall of 1960, everything that Symbolmatix recommended Kennedy do, Kennedy did. And so when he won, Symbolmatix took credit.
Right. And so among those were formally embracing civil rights in a way that he really hadn't before, openly acknowledging that there were questions about his Catholic faith and addressing that directly. And whether it carried the day or not, that's what he did, and he won.
Yeah. And a really interesting measure of the difference between this era and our era is that the Kennedy campaign did not expect Symbolmatix to take credit or even to take any public role whatsoever. The idea that if you were going to hire such a company, you should probably not admit to it seems to have been the one that animated, especially Bobby Kennedy, who was furious when Symbolmatix started saying, oh, well, you know, we're responsible for Kennedy's victory.
Right. Well, one of my favorite parts of this story is what happens after the 1960 election, which is that in January, a story appears in Harper's Magazine about Symbolmatix and its role in the Kennedy campaign. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's an article called The People Machine, which is like super spooky sounding. And it's by this guy, Thomas B. Morgan, who's a freelance writer. He's written for Harper's and Esquire, a lot of other places. Morgan does not reveal that he's Ed Greenfield's best friend and that he also was the editor of all those reports. And he goes on to become the director of PR.
The editor of reports that they did for the Kennedy campaign. He was right in the middle of this, but none of this is disclosed in the story.
No, he doesn't disclose any of it. But it is actually a really interesting article, and it's not entirely all boosterism. I mean, Morgan very carefully raises all the ethical questions around, well, okay, so this happened, and we're not 100% sure that it swayed the election, but we should be asking some questions about whether this is if it does sway elections, is this okay? Is this the right thing to do? But what the Kennedy campaign sees is just this big headline that says Kennedy used a robot, deferred to a robot, like that his campaign was run by a robot, and Kennedy had run with a lot of opposition to automation, which is a big electoral issue in 1960. So put him in a real pickle. And it was kind of a great story. So it wasn't so much the Harper story, but this is right before the inauguration. All over the country, newspapers, even little newspapers, picked it up and wrote about it. We've elected a robot president. It was just kind of 1960s automation dystopia stuff just kind of all leaks out of this story. And suddenly the nation's like, oh, whoa, this could be really bad. And so the Kennedy campaign has to try to, you know, backtrack. And Pierre Salinger, the spokesperson, says, oh, no, we've never even heard of Symbolmatix, which is just, you know, not true.
Just that was a lie, wasn't it?
there's a lot of spin around whether Kennedy had in fact been elected by a computer.
Right. So, but this idea that he had a secret weapon, which was a robot, it also provoked serious debate among people who were concerned about the future of democracy, right?
Yeah, it does. And I think the argument that wins out eventually, honestly, is the argument that's put forward by Ithiel de Solapool, who's the MIT political scientist, who's the chairman of the research board for this new company, Symbolmatix. He says, you want a political candidate to have as much information as possible. This is information that our technology and scientific research is now able to provide to political campaigns. So who wants to stand in the way of knowledge? Knowledge is a good thing. And progress will be when the other side also has a people machine. If we have two people machines fighting against one another, then that's fair. And that's actually the argument that wins.
All right, so on the strength of all of the attention that it got in the 1960 election, Simulmatics is a hot commodity, and Ed Greenfield sees a world of new clients he can pitch. Who do they pitch to, and what do they tell them they can do?
The clientele that they reach out to, some of which they succeed in bringing in, advertising agencies and, you know, big retailers, Colgate, Palmolive, Ralston, Purina, those kinds of people. They do kind of brand switching ad campaigns for them. They have to say, you know, we have this imaginary population of consumers. We have some consumer data that, you know, we've gotten from you or we get from ad agencies. And we can predict, you know, who's going to switch to your dog food if you say your dog food tastes good versus who's going to switch to your dog food if you say your dog food makes your dog more energetic. And they do, you know, just very kind of standard fare today. But it's pioneering at the time. Everything that, you know, is done now, they're proposing then.
Right. I mean, they claimed they had this people machine, which is really kind of a concept. But if I have this right, what they were telling potential clients was that they have crafted 3,000 perfectly representative, though imaginary, people that have all of these characteristics that are sliced in categories that you could test anything on, you know, dog food, breakfast cereal, political messaging, whatever. How close did they come to actually having the goods they were promising?
You know, that I find difficult to tell. I found in the archives 10,000 or so punch cards from the election research, and, you know, with a bunch of people, including people at the Computer History Museum, tried to rerun the people machine, like tried to turn it, switch it back on and see, to have some measure of assessment of it. We couldn't get the Fortran program cards to work, so it's difficult to assess. You know, we still don't know, for instance, the effect that Cambridge Analytica had on the 2016 Trump campaign or the 2015 Brexit campaign, right? Like, Cambridge Analytica would like us to think that it had a huge effect, but how measurable is it even now with the tools that we have to measure? It's quite difficult to say.
Yeah, it did strike me that, I mean, that even though they were probably promising more than they had, they were really successful in getting all these Fortune 500 companies. And it just reminds me that then as now, success in consulting has a lot more to do with personal relationships and salesmanship than actually delivering meaningful services.
Yeah, I mean, there's a trade industry newsletter, I think in 1962, puts out a story called The Great Computer Hoax, in which this guy's like, look, the emperor has no clothes. Like, Simulmatics and these other companies that are following, you know, these kind of copycat companies, they got nothing. Like, you can eyeball this, guys. Like, this is a lot of money for nothing.
How did you come upon this story?
In 2015, I had an assignment from The New Yorker to write kind of an assessment of the state of the polling industry. And I wrote a piece called Politics and the New Machine. And it struck me at the time, really early in my research, that polling is certainly should be, I guess, obsolete in that, you know, with the advent of data analytics companies, data science, modern political data science, you don't have to call somebody up and ask them, you know, 100 questions to know how they might vote or what they believe about, you know, Biden's latest speech or Trump's latest action. Because you can find out, you can collect data about them. That's how politics actually works. So I was interested in then, in, for the purpose of the piece, in answering, like, when did that begin? If polling is being replaced by data science, when did that begin? And that took me to Simulmatics and the 1960 election work.
You know, the stuff that they did that was so controversial, I mean, the idea that you could assemble data and predict how people would react to a political idea or a new product, which was controversial then, is just so completely normal now. And people are collecting, you know, untold amounts of data from us in so many ways, you know, Google and Facebook and hundreds of others. What's the place of Simulmatics in the story of data and its use in the country?
You know, I was just reading this quite chilling piece by Sue Halpern in The New Yorker this week about an app that the Trump campaign has been using and how effective it is at drawing your contacts information and then also geolocating information in order to send you particular messages, and not only to you, but also to everybody in your contacts list. and have gathered information about each of them by cell phone number, which is kind of the gold standard in doing voter research, right? Because you can then, if you know your cell phone number, you know kind of everything. And I was really struck reading that we have nothing that stops this app from going into your contact lists and gathering all this information, not only about you, but about everybody else that you know, and then submitting messages to them in your name. How we got to this place is because no one said no to Simulmatics.
You know, a lot of this is about how you can manipulate voters. What are you thinking about as you look to the coming election?
When I think about what Simulmatics started doing was really trying to convince the Democratic Party to count Black voters. Black voters matter, really, was Ed Greenfield's message. We're going to show you that mathematically. We're going to build a computer. We're going to build a people machine that can show you that Black voters matter because we need to be stronger on civil rights. Like, it starts with this really noble commitment to civil rights. But what it produces is the world that we have today, where we're all so segmented and micro-messaged to that we have no sense of a common good any longer, which is how, you know, a democracy has to work. Like, we actually are not supposed to be going into a voting booth and voting or sealing a ballot and sticking in an envelope and voting the way our demographic micro-segment says we must, because we're actually supposed to be looking at that ballot and thinking about what's good for everyone. That notion of the public good and the public interest, which is just the ground on which a democracy stands, is falling away from beneath our feet.
Right. And I guess if those of us who cover elections spend all of our time talking about just the hard politics of it, you know, how demographics will work, that's time we could be spending talking about what's good for the country.
Yeah. Instead of just reporting the latest national poll, which doesn't really tell us anything since we live in an electoral college system anyway, I think there are deeper moral and ethical questions that, you know, good reporters are always wrestling with, but I would like to hear voters on more. And I would like to hear that a lot more. I mean, I recognize the sexiness and the fun of, you know, 538 and the kind of gamesmanship and everything is baseball now. Or baseball is now computing. but, you know, I don't like to watch the game where they change the pitcher every three batters because they've got the numbers to do that. Like, baseball is baseball and democracy is democracy.
Well, Jill Lepore, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thanks so much, Dave. It was a real pleasure.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her book is If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. The latest series from Ryan Murphy, whose credits include Glee, Pose, and American Horror Story, is now streaming on Netflix. The new drama series, called Ratchet, is a prequel of sorts to the Oscar-winning movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It stars Sarah Paulson as a younger version of the character played by Louise Fletcher, Nurse Ratchet. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
It's been 45 years now since the movie adaptation of Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest hit the screen. And hit it so hard that it wound up winning Oscars for Best Movie, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Actress. The director was Milos Forman. The actor, playing anti-establishment rebel R.P. McMurphy, was Jack Nicholson. And the actress, playing the ultimate authority figure Nurse Ratched, was Louise Fletcher. Now, almost half a century later, Nurse Ratched has been given a first name. Spoiler alert, it's Mildred. And a backstory. What happened to Nurse Ratched in her earlier days to make her so tightly coiled, so unyieldingly authoritarian, so seemingly devoid of empathy and feeling? That's the mystery that Ratched, the new Netflix miniseries from Glee and Pose co-creator Ryan Murphy, sets out to solve. And Ryan has given the title role to one of the breakout star players from his American Horror Story anthology series, Sarah Paulson. Over the past 9 years, Sarah Paulson has played a dozen different roles on American Horror Story. In one season, titled Freak Show, she played two at once, as conjoined twins. In other series co-created by Ryan Murphy, she's played Geraldine Page in Feud, Betty and Joan, and, most impressively, O.J. Simpson prosecutor Marcia Clark in American Crime Story. And when not playing in Murphy's sandbox, she's appeared in the movie 12 Years a Slave and in such powerful TV dramas as the recent Mrs. America miniseries and the classic Western series Deadwood. So in my mind, she's a great pick for Nurse Ratched. She's got the range, the skill, and what may be most important, the steely demeanor and confidence to play this iconic character. She's also got to be good enough to hold her own against some very strong and scene-stealing performers. And this miniseries is full of them, from Sharon Stone and Cynthia Nixon to Amanda Plummer and Vincent D'Onofrio. Most of these actors play their roles over the top, as though they were appearing in a Sweeney Todd type of very dark, gothic comedy drama. But that matches the approach of co-creators Ryan Murphy and Evan Romansky. The music, the set direction, the photography, everything here is saturated rather than subdued. The inspiration for Ratched may be an ultimately tragic tale, but there was a lot of humor in Cuckoo's Nest, both the movie and Kesey's original book as well, and this new Netflix miniseries doubles down on that. One of the best supporting players in Ratched is Judy Davis, who, when we meet her, is sort of a prototypical Nurse Ratched. She plays head nurse Betsy Bucket, who presides over the asylum where Mildred Ratched is applying for a job. Mildred has ulterior motives for wanting to work there, so she's forged a letter from the doctor who runs the place to offer her a job interview. The officious Nurse Bucket is understandably suspicious, but young Nurse Ratched, even without any position of authority, quickly grabs the upper hand. The actresses and the music set the tone for the playful power struggles to come.
Where did you get this? You must be the head nurse. Mildred Ratched.
I didn't ask what your name was. Where did you get the letter?
Why, it was sent to me.
That's where I'm confused. Because there is no one in his office except for Dr. Hanover and myself. I didn't send that, and I can assure you that isn't Dr. Hanover's signature.
I have come quite a long way and would just like to speak with him.
Dr. Hanover is out of the office till later this afternoon. If you'd like to leave a number,
if
where
you don't mind, I'd prefer to wait here.
He'll be gone sometime.
You just said he'd return in the afternoon.
It could be longer.
Well, then it could be shorter. By your own logic. I truly don't mind waiting. I have nowhere else to be.
Very well.
Things don't always go that smoothly for Mildred. In this series, she's victim as much as predator, though she persists and obviously ultimately prevails. As the narrative unfolds, there are outbursts of violence in this Ratched miniseries. Some are too aggressive and gratuitously brutal, while others are just shocking enough to deliver the surprise impact they're supposed to. Not every character in this drama survives, but while they're around, they make quite an impression. D'Onofrio, Davis, and Plummer especially. But holding it all together here is Paulson, skillfully managing a very complicated and dominant character arc. The tone of Ratched is closest to the larger-than-life theatrics of Feud, Betty, and Joan. But instead of Betty Davis versus Joan Crawford, this new miniseries is more like Nurse Ratched versus everybody.
David Biancooley is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and professor of TV studies at Rowan University. Coming up, we hear from playwright and novelist Ayad Akhtar. His new novel, Homeland Elegies, explores the experiences of a Muslim man growing up in Wisconsin, the son of Pakistani immigrants, as Akhtar did. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in today for Terry Gross. Our guest today is writer, playwright, and actor Ayad Akhtar. He was born in the United States to parents who immigrated from Pakistan, and much of his writing deals with the experiences of Muslims in America. He co-wrote and starred in the 2005 film The War Within. His first produced play, Disgraced, won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. He was last on Fresh Air in 2012 to talk about his first novel, American Dervish, inspired by his own experiences growing up as a Muslim in a rural suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the 1980s. He has a new novel which also draws on his experiences and those of his extended family. It's part family narrative, part social and political commentary, and a reflection on the meaning of religious and national identity. It's called Homeland Elegies. Ayad Akhtar joins me from his apartment in New York City. Ayad Akhtar, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
I'd like to begin with a reading from the book, which is told in the first person by someone named Akhtar.
Ayad Akhtar, actually.
Ayad Akhtar.
Yeah.
Okay, not exactly you, but someone like you, a person who bears your name. Anyway, this is kind of a rather remarkable coincidence in that the narrator's father is a cardiologist who actually has had Donald Trump as a patient. You want to set this reading up for us and read it?
Sure. The book begins with a narrative in which, you know, my father in the book is the doctor for Donald Trump in the mid-90s for a few years, and is part of a medical team dealing with certain heart arrhythmia issues. And my father, in reality, was also a specialist of arrhythmias, a world specialist, and was often called in on such occasions. And so my father in the book is flown to New York City, and he is put up at the Plaza in order to examine Donald Trump for the first time. And I think the section you'd like me to read is really their first conversation, because Trump doesn't show up to his appointment. So I'll begin there. That night, in the room at the Plaza Hotel that had been arranged for him, Father's bedside phone rang just as he was falling asleep. It was Donald himself. What follows is my approximation of their conversation, shaped by Father's recollection of, above all, the man's solicitousness. "No one seems to know how to say it, doctor."
"Nothing new there."
"How do you say it?"
"Akhtar."
"So Ak, like octopus?"
"That works."
"But is that how you say it? Where you're from? Where are you from?"
"Pakistan."
"Pakistan.
And we pronounce the name differently there."
"I'm talented. I can say it right."
"So we say Akhtar."
Father reverted to the native KH guttural sound that no white American in his experience had ever been able to master. There was a moment's silence on the other end of the line.
"Oh, that sounds hard. I don't know about that, doctor."
"Akhtar is fine, Mr. Trump." They both laughed.
Okay, Akhtar it is, and you call me Donald, please."
Trump then proceeded to apologize for missing his appointment. Disarmed by his warmth, Father demurred. Trump asked if his room was big enough. "It's New York City, hard to feel you ever have enough space, but I had them put you in a nice suite. Do you like it? We redid those rooms when I bought the place."
"Mr. Trump, that hotel is a masterpiece, doctor. The Mona Lisa, that's what it is."
"Mr. Trump, call me Donald, please."
"Please excuse me, Donald. I didn't come to New York to stay in a nice hotel. I came here to help you." "I'm not sure you understand how serious this problem with your heart could be if you have Brugada. I'm not exaggerating when I say you are a walking time bomb. You could be dead tomorrow."
There was silence. Father continued,
"I'm flattered to receive the royal treatment from you, Donald, but I just came from Brunei, where I treated the Sultan of Brunei. He is a king. And he was on time for his appointment because he understood that if he doesn't get it taken care of, he might be dead tomorrow."
"Okay, doctor," Trump said blankly after a short pause. "I'll be there. What time?"
8 a.m.
"I'm sorry I missed it today. I'm very sorry, doctor. It wasn't respectful of you or your time. I apologize. I mean it."
"It's fine, Donald. You forgive me?"
Father laughed.
"Okay, good. You're laughing," Trump said. "I'm sorry about today, but I will be there tomorrow, first thing, I promise."
And that is our guest Ayad Akhtar reading from his new novel, Homeland Elegies, a reconstructed conversation with the narrator's father, the cardiologist, and Donald Trump. And I have to say, this is completely unbelievable because we hear Donald Trump actually apologize in this exchange.
well, that becomes the basis of the whole chapter, because during the 2015 and 2016 election, as folks were complaining about Trump not being able to apologize, the narrator's father is constantly saying, of course, you see, they're wrong, because he can apologize. I know it. He apologized to me. He was very nice to me. And he's not the person that they're making him out to be. And that's really the subject of the first chapter, is the support that my father, in this case in the book, is showing Donald Trump during this period, during his election.
But just so that we're clear about this, you, Ayad Akhtar, the writer, it is true that your father was a cardiologist who did treat Donald Trump?
I'm not going to answer that question, David, not just for legal reasons. I mean, you know, there's so much in the book that's drawn from fact and so much of it that's, you know, deformed for the purposes of fiction. And, you know, there's a purpose behind it. I wanted to find a way to write about the present, to write about the political realities that we're dealing with, to write about the nation that we have become, the insanity that has become our lives today. And I wanted to do it in fiction. But any form of doing it in fiction felt to me, in my hands at least, that it was going to read like satire. And the only way to work against that was to pivot into memoir and to sort of begin the process of ensnaring the reader in this game of illusion and reality, of truth and fiction. Again, there's so much that is true and so much that's verifiably true and so much that's unverifiably true. But that question about what is real and what's not real is at the heart of what we're dealing with every day in our lives. And I wanted the texture of the book to reflect that confusion.
The father of the narrator in your novel has this experience with Donald Trump, and he treats him, sees him as a cardiologist, and then they have a couple of dinners and a couple of lunches, and he has this enduring affection. Like, you know, you people who criticize Donald don't know him like I do. Does this character, does he continue to support Donald Trump after he becomes a candidate and proposes a ban on Muslims, for example, immigrating?
Yes, it becomes a big source of conflict between myself as narrator and my father in the book, in which I don't understand how he is saying that. Why doesn't he believe he is also going to be subject to the Muslim ban? But, you know, the father in the book doesn't seem to think that he's Muslim. He doesn't define himself as Muslim. He thinks of himself as post-Muslim, if you will. Doesn't believe anymore. He has all of these opinions that he goes on about. And so for some reason doesn't think that he's going to suffer the consequences.
So he has embraced the American dream, believes the country has been terrific for him, right?
Yeah, he's embraced an outsized, debt-fueled, ersatz version of limitless American individualism. And all of that is embodied by Donald Trump, and all of that is embodied by his passion and his bromance, if you will, with the Donald. You know, and of course, right after that chapter is a chapter about my mother's political consciousness, which is really the other side of the coin, sort of anti-Americanism. And it was, you know, something that was that conflict was something that I experienced in my house very vividly, very similar to the way that it unfolds in the book.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. What kinds of conversations you heard your parents have involving Pakistan and whether they wanted to stay in the United States or how they felt about the country they'd come from?
Well, my mom, as the narrator's mother in the book, was very homesick, I think, for the homeland, for what she called back home. And I don't think quite understood what all the big deal was about the United States, in the sense that, you know, it felt like opportunity was really just the opportunity to make money, and that American superiority was really just about wealth. And she didn't feel, I think, that the compensations that she had that she was getting from her new culture were worth what she had left behind. And there was a moroseness to all of that. And my father, was very much a sort of self-made, self-styled businessman, entrepreneur, doctor, who I think believed that he was thriving and loved the freedom to make money in this country and the freedom to sort of innovate, if you will. And that was a constant source of back and forth. And, you know, I think my mom always felt I was a little too friendly to my dad's point of view. And I think my dad always sort of looked at me and thought I was a little too friendly to my mom's. So I was caught in the middle. But it gave me a good perspective on both.
And what was your mom missing?
Home. She was missing her family. She was missing the smells, the tastes, the sounds. She was missing a sense of belonging. She was missing a culture that knew where she came from. She was missing a culture that valued death. She was missing a culture that respected elders. She was missing everything she thought mattered in life, because life here was lonely. And, you know, she ended up in a part of Wisconsin where it was covered in snow most of the time, and, you know, by herself. And, you know, my dad was off at work. So, you know, one can understand the sense of exile and the sense of homelessness, or at least homesickness.
And did she, and do you remember experiencing discrimination then? I mean, there weren't a lot of Muslims around that community, right?
You know, this was before 9/11. And my feeling growing up in Wisconsin, you know, was, and Wisconsin has changed a lot over the years, but I didn't feel excluded. I mean, I knew we were different, but nobody ever made me feel discriminated against because of it. You know, I grew up with good, smart, wholesome people. I mean, it sounds cliched, but it really is true. I think things have changed in Wisconsin since. I mean, but back then, And this was before 9/11, mind you. That was in, it was, there wasn't really a sense really that anybody knew who we were, where we were from, what it meant that we were from Pakistan or that we were Muslims. That's part of what irritated my mom, too, is that, you know, Americans don't seem to know anything about anything other than their own stuff.
As I understand it, you were not raised in an observant Muslim home, but that you undertook a serious study of the Quran and a lot of other religious and spiritual texts as an adult. How would you describe your relationship to Islam today?
You know, I tend to follow the lead of some of my, you know, Jewish friends who since college have called themselves cultural Jews, and I sort of appropriated that and started calling myself a cultural Muslim in the sense that, you know, Islam is an important part of my childhood. It's an important part of my formation, and it's an important part of how I am sure I see the world at a very profound level. And I'm proud of all those things, but I'm not a believer in the sense that I don't think that the revelation to Muhammad by Allah is the unique source of truth in human history. I find inspiration in it, but I'm not a literal believer.
You were born and raised in the United States. You were about 30 when 9/11 happened, if I'm doing the math right. Were you in New York then?
I was.
Right. Well, the narrator in this case, he lives in Manhattan, goes on the street and ends up joining a lot of people to donate blood, and then is accosted in line by some people who recognize him as, you know, other, and he gets a lot of grief.
I mean, a mild version of the sorts of things, obviously, that not only I, but many others have experienced. In this case, it's a harrowing scene because everyone's terrified and everyone's aggrieved and confused. And when this argument erupts in this line, the narrator urinates himself out of fear, which then leads him to sort of flee, if you will, and ends up in a Salvation Army store where he is shown some kindness by a fellow in a priest collar. And as the fellow goes back to get him a glass of water, the narrator pilfers a necklace that's got a cross on it, from the jewelry stand, tries to pay for it before he leaves, but the priest won't take any money, and then wears that cross for months in order to sort of signify, to pass, if you will. You know, yes, the marker of the skin is clear, is a clear indication of some otherness, but the cross tells a different story. And as he tells this story to his Pakistani-American girlfriend, she's appalled. She's absolutely horrified that he's telling her all of this and that he would wear a cross to pass in order to protect himself.
So let me ask you, the real Ayad Akhtar, apart from the narrative in the book, I mean, did you feel the treatment that you received from strangers just changed immediately after the 9/11 attacks?
No question. No question. We went from being, you know, invisible to being visible as a threat. You know, as my mother would say, before 9/11, they had no idea who we were, where we were from. And after 9/11, we could have only been from somewhere bad. And I had the good fortune of not growing up as a kid in that environment. I think the real challenge has been for kids having to grow up post 9/11, you know, in the Muslim community, in the Muslim American community. That's been hard.
Right. I would imagine that your experience in New York was probably different from your parents who were still in Wisconsin. What was it like for you? What was it like for them?
Well, you know, for my mother, there was a period of time where she didn't leave the house. So it was, you know, it was a long period of time, actually. You know, every time you feel the suspicion, just be worried, concerned. And then that led to a sense of, you know, maybe unwarranted a degree of paranoia around all of it. But obviously coming from some very real experience that she had been having in New York. You know, it felt that it lasted a few months, and the apex of it really was the anthrax scare. There was the World Trade Center attacks, and then there was the, you know, the plane that came down in Queens, and then there were these anthrax attacks. That was really felt like the apogee of the fear and terror, and that was a hard time to just be on a city bus or to be walking down the street or anything.
You know, your father, who embraced life in the United States and always said he loved the country, he liked visiting, I guess the father in the book, at least, you know, loved visiting historic sites in the United States. In the end, returns to Pakistan after he retires. And there's a long and fascinating story about his life that we probably can't get into here. But I'm wondering, How did your dad feel about Pakistan, and how did he feel about his American experience? And this was after, I should say, after his wife, your mom, had passed away.
At the end of his life, he was talking constantly about wanting to go home. You know, while he had felt America was his home most of his life, now home was Pakistan, and he longed to return, and I think felt that his American journey had come to an end. And I think felt that, you know, he wanted to experience again the things that he had grown up with and the people that he'd known, and he missed family, and he missed, you know, the things that my mother had missed her whole life. My father didn't seem to miss until the end of his life. You know, one of the weird concordances in writing the book, you know, it's one way that I sort of talk about the kind of complexity of this fact and fiction interweave. My father, actually, the last quarter of the book is a chapter about the end of my father's life in America, the end of his story in America. And the day that I finished that chapter is actually the day that my father fell, hit his head, and ended up in ICU and died shortly thereafter. And I hadn't yet written the coda in which he returns home to Pakistan. So in a way, the coda is my gift, if you will. I mean, you know, he's no longer here to receive it, but to his idea, to the thought of him, to the memory of him, giving him what he was longing for in the last few years of his life.
Well, Ayad Akhtar, thanks for speaking with us. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Dave.
Ayad Akhtar is an actor, novelist, and playwright. His new novel is Homeland Elegies.